warm welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. I'm the editor and webmaster of redicecreations.com. And this is our internet talk radio show recorded from the west coast of Sweden. You can join us here every Thursday and Sunday for our regular program. And don't miss out on our subscribers section if you want to have full access to our growing radio archive. Today we have Jake Kutze back with us on the program. Mr. Kutze, of course, is behind the excellent blog thebravenewworldorder.blogspot.com, and Jake is behind the concept of synchromysticism. Beyond the regular postings that Jake do on his blog, he has been producing some brilliant videos based on his articles, research, and his concept. And today I hope to talk with Jake about some of his latest videos and even maybe the method of how he's working with the video material and a lot of interesting points that Jake has brought out in the last few videos that he has been producing. So let's say welcome back to Jake, and thank you so much for joining us. It's very nice to finally have you on the line, Jake.
It's a pleasure, Henrik. Thank you.
Excellent. How are you, my friend, and how are things over there?
Oh, very good. Very good. And yourself?
I'm doing very fine, thank you. Yeah, we have some problems here connecting with Jake, but I think hopefully the line will hold here and we'll be able to do the entire show. But, you know, to thinking of your production of the video material, I think it's really, really good, and it feels like you're kind of knocking it up a notch for every new video that you release. I think it's getting better and better all the time. And also, of course, I think the use of video material is an excellent kind of medium to get your message and idea across. Let me ask you, how do you find it working with video? Is it easy, more difficult? How's your method?
Well, it's been a very interesting process for me, because I've had to teach myself how to do it, and it's just been getting more and more layers to it the more I've been getting into it, tweaking with sound and playing with all these features. But I had to teach myself how to do it, and moving from writing primarily to, at the moment, I'm concentrating on doing the videos, it's proved to be challenging. I feel like I can it's not as expressive personally of your feelings, but it is more it does sort of show the idea of synchromysticism, specifically related to movies and motion picture, very well, because you actually show a clip instead of just a still from it.
That's right. Yeah,
I think it works better for what I'm trying to do at the moment.
Absolutely. And let me ask you, how is the, you know, planning aspect of it? Do you kind of storyboard all the stuff that you work on, or do you kind of use your some of your articles as the main blueprint, as the base storyline for the videos?
Well, in the beginning, I was using my articles and just sort of trying to translate them into films, little short movies, and then I sort of progressed to actually developing new ideas with the films, and I've just found that it's sort of changed the way I look at the synchromysticism, and they sort of develop as I'm making them. I do not have a completely set out idea. I have a rough overview, but generally, as I'm working with it, I will get ideas, and I'll realize that something is really going to connect very well with this other idea. So I'll keep going back and forth. There is an overarching idea, but generally they develop as well as I'm making them.
So do it, you know, does it take a long time to get them together, the pieces? They're about, you know, I think the duration time is very good, you know, as it is now. I guess it's more around 10 to 15 to 20 minutes, something like that. But does it take a long time to get them together?
They take generally, at the moment, they seem to keep increasing as I'm developing my technique. I feel they're increasing in difficulty because I'm trying to put more effort into them.
Yeah.
I keep trying to make them better. So the gestation period is more time and effort, but I want to increase the quality of the production and teach myself how to do it. And the 10-minute mark is generally because of that's the maximum amount you can upload on the popular sites like YouTube. So I've been sticking to the 10 minutes. And like at the moment, I'm actually working on videos that are longer, but I'm cutting them into parts.
Ah, okay. How about, don't they allow longer on Video Google?
They do. I fought about Google, but I have so many people as subscribers on my channel on YouTube that I sort of felt like I could just stay on YouTube for a while. And I've grown comfortable with it for now, but I might experiment with other programs. Who knows what will develop?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
the internet is changing so fast.
That's right, absolutely. You know, this is one of the questions. Nice to hear that you're working on longer pieces. Yeah, I did wanted to ask you kind of, you know, the plans for your future, because as you say, I think the quality of every video is increasing all the time, and it feels that you're, you know, certainly are developing. So, you know, what are your plans for the, for the future?
Well, for now, I'm planning to keep them in the 10-minute length, make some that are, you know, more than one part, maybe two or three parts. And then eventually move on to maybe episode length, like, or documentary length. Maybe I'll just take more time and consolidate everything I have into a movie feature length or something like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, admittedly, at the moment, the videos are, you know, all very low production values. I'm making them alone in my apartment on my computer. It's there's nothing flashy about them. But I'm keeping developing the idea, and eventually I'll have other people helping me out with that kind of thing. And who knows where it'll go. I'm taking it as it comes.
Absolutely, yeah.
At the moment.
Absolutely.
And they're also very, I think they're more popular than the articles I write, because people can get it quickly. 10 minutes, you can get the idea, and you can go on instead of sitting for an hour and reading a very in-depth article. You can get that information across very quickly, but I do feel you sort of give prize your own expression when it comes to how you feel about what you're saying.
And isn't that right? Because we just talked about that, you know, before we came on air, about the fact that there's so much information out there, and I think that one of the advantages with, you know, both working with video but also you know, is the ability to actually kind of condense the material and make it into, you know, very short but very powerful pieces. And that kind of is the idea of what it is about nowadays, I think, because, as you say, people can sit for, you know, hours and you know, it, and it never boils down to the, you know, concrete, the good
and
pieces.
And in the media space, on the internet, there's so much competing for attention. You want to keep things short and concise and powerful, because a lot of people don't have an hour to sit there, or unfortunately we don't have the attention span, or there's just so much out there that you want to maybe just watch for 10 minutes because you've got 10 other things you want to do tonight as well before you go to bed.
Absolutely.
So that medium is working for me at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Perhaps I will save the writing and work on a book or something in the background.
Yeah,
making these, and then that could be another way for me to express myself.
Absolutely,
lacking in the videos.
I mean, what do you use, like Windows Movie Maker or something like that now, or more fancy
standard
software?
Just standard. I download torrents and I go to work on Windows. It's nothing fancy.
Yeah, sure. But again, it shows you, you know, what you can do these days with very simple tools. You know, and
exactly. Alone in your apartment, no problem. Anybody.
Absolutely, yeah.
Self-taught. It's amazing what you can do with technology at the moment.
Absolutely, I totally agree. And again, I mean, I wish you all the best, you know, for the continuation of the production in the future. And as I say, I think more is, it's getting better and better all the time. So you know, I can't wait for the next one. That's the entire, you know, the feeling I get, you know, every time I watch one. Like, oh man, this is going to be so good. So continue.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That, by the way, let's talk a little bit about your latest piece. I don't know if you're working on one right now, but the one you have up on your blog now is called the 9/11 Stargate video, and there's some very interesting, you know, points in this video, and I think there's a few points that you mentioned in one of your previous posts on your blog, and this is one of them. Of course, is about the sphere outside the World Trade Center building, and there is an interesting story behind it all, and some of the connections that you mentioned in the video. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
For sure, yeah. The sphere is a sculpture that used to stand right in between the two towers of the World Trade Center, and was made by Fritz Kunig, and it was intended by the designer of the World Trade Center Plaza, the famous designer Yamasaki. He intended that sphere to represent the Kaaba at Mecca, the because it has these concentric circles around it. It was set in the middle of a fountain, and the idea was that it would rotate, and he wanted this to be a representation of the Kaaba at Mecca. And that is a very interesting thing in itself, because the Kaaba is this cuboid structure, and I trace it back to being descended from the holiest of holies, you know, the cuboid shape from the Great Pyramid or the King's Chamber, and also the Tabernacle, and these concepts, the Abrahamic faiths, they have this fascination with the cuboid shape, the ark being another famous one. Even Noah's Ark is also actually a cuboid, if you think about it, and that's part of what I'm working on at the moment. But
interesting.
the sphere, the sphere stood in between the World Trade Center, and if people who are familiar with the concepts that the towers could very likely have represented Jachin and Boaz, it's sort of like we have a representation of the holiest of holies in between the two towers. And earlier I've speculated that when the towers came down, it was sort of a unveiling ritual. The holy light was coming out and Isis was released, and now we have a symbol right in between them of the holiest of holies, the Kaaba, and the towers coming down. So I thought that was a very fascinating sort of, to me, a confirmation of the whole idea of the 9/11 as a ritual.
Absolutely. Do you know if that's the, what should you call it, the official version, that this actually is a mimicking the Kaaba stone?
Yeah, it's Wikipedia. I didn't get that from like some strange esoteric site. Wikipedia.
Yeah.
It's a general idea that it was intended to be the Kaaba. Obviously, the interpretation of it being part of a mega ritual on 9/11 would be fringe, but no, that it's intended to be the Kaaba. That's consensus stuff.
Interesting. You know, and it's of course interesting that we have the kind of the Islamic or Muslim connection, you know, with the ritual itself, at least on the, again, official version of the story of what happened that day. But it's interesting that they actually, you know, managed to put something like that in you know, in the financial center of a Western country, if you think about it.
Exactly. It's very fascinating. And in that video also I explain about how in the movie The Wiz, which came up to me because of a lot of people on the internet were talking about it. Synchronous 23 was talking about how she had connected the idea of Awas and the Wizard of Oz, the look of the Wizard of Oz, and also the words Oz are, Aleister Crowley used that in Liber 77. He had this symbol of Oz. And in the film The Wiz, we see the sphere, this representation of the Kaaba, which I sometimes connect to the Ben stone, depending on how you trace back these things. We have the word Oz, Crowley 77, right on the sphere in between the World Trade Center, which was Jachin and Boaz, or the pyramids, in another way of looking at it, if you follow Ralph Ellis's version of Jachin and Boaz. Another Muslimic connection that I just thought of that I hardly ever bring up, but that I think should still be looked into, is when Flight 93 crashed, they're building a memorial there. The original design on the grounds where the memorial was built was a crescent, a red crescent that was facing Mecca.
Yeah.
Pressure came down onto the designers, and I think they've changed it. I'm not sure what the story is at the moment about that memorial that they were designing, but it was a giant sea, like the crescent moon of the Muslim faith, pointing towards Mecca, where Flight 93 crashed. It's very bizarre.
Oh, man.
And that you can also check on Wikipedia. That's not fringe. Just the interpretation, again, would be fringe, but it's normal.
Amazing. Yeah, absolutely. And I think even the... some researchers have pointed to the connection between Atlantis and the sea. Isn't that right?
That's right, yeah. I've heard William Henry talk about a red sea shape as connected to Atlantis, and that's also something that I keep mulling over in my head. Where does the Red Sea come from? Connected to the Red Sea, perhaps?
Exactly.
The actual body of water?
Yeah.
what exactly is that Red Sea? I is it connected to the reef symbol, which is a sort of a C shape that you'll see around the UN flag, you know, like the reef of the Romans? I don't know. I keep mulling over the C shape. It could also be the canals of Plato's Atlantis had one big trench going through. So maybe that cut is where the Atlantean Sea comes from.
Ah, yeah, like the concentric circles going around more and more inwards.
Right.
Yeah.
Cut by one major canal. So maybe that's the connection to the Red Sea. So, and you could also think of the pillars of Twin Towers as the Atlantean pillars, the pillars of Hercules. So there's an Atlantean connection there as well. And if we think of Francis Bacon and the New Atlantis and the New World Order, then yeah, we're sort of at the same stuff, whether we think of them as Jacob and Boaz or the pillars of Atlantis or whatever.
Absolutely, yeah. It goes round and round in that, you know, entire area where a few key concepts or mythologies keeps repeating and coming up, you know, again and again and again, and you can find it, you know, in everything. And that's the, you know, the incredible thing with your work also, that you kind of, you know, incorporate that and that, you know. One thing that I wanted to ask you about also, of course, is because you mentioned United 93, and there is even in that film a connection to the Wizard of Oz with the Emerald City, right?
That's right. Yeah, one of the passengers on board in the film, United 93, looks at the guy sitting next to him, and he's explaining to him how beautiful New York City was, and he says it looked like Emerald City. And and then, so there's another 9/11 connection to the Wizard of Oz, and I've strung them all together in that video, and people can go have a look if they want to get a feel. It's difficult to explain synchromysticism when you're talking, because you want to sort of talk while you're seeing the image. But we can definitely try.
Absolutely, yeah, of course. And even the, you know, another guy that comes up again is the in the Wiz, or the original, as I should say, the Wizard of Oz. The face that is portrayed, you know, very similar to Iwas. We have the Crowley connection again. We have even the connection with the typical gray, I guess, and that connects with your work, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Another thing about Crowley that we should remember is that he meditated in the King's Chamber, the sacred cuboid of the Abrahamic faith.
Hmm.
You know, and I follow Michael Tessarian and Ralph Ellis's thinking on this matter when it comes to the Muslim, the Jewish, and the Christian faiths, and Masonry as well, being all traced back to ancient Egypt and perhaps further into Atlantis or whatever. That thread seems to go beyond Egypt to somewhere. It might not be exactly what we think. I have different ideas on Atlantis, but that's something I'm developing right now.
Yeah.
If you have to at least take it as far back as the pyramids and Egypt.
Yeah.
To get the mega ritual idea of the Stargate and Aleister Crowley and how it all connects to the World Trade Center.
Yeah, absolutely. You know. In your previous articles, you pointed out also the you know, the incredible connection between the entire, you know, Manhattan area as the, you know, representation, I guess, of the primordial mound, I guess.
Yes, that's right. It seemed to me I discovered on a certificate, or a Masonic third degree initiation certificate, or whatever you'd call it. I bought one at a flea market, and on it I found like an incredible picture of the mound rising from the big waters, which is the Egyptian creation myth. It's like a rock, the primordial mound coming out of the water, and on top of it is the three candles that you'll see in the lodge in Masonry.
Yeah.
And if you follow the first degree tracing board symbolism again with the three pillars, which Ralph Ellis connects with the pyramids of Egypt, then the idea is that we're looking at the mound with, which is sort of like Giza or even the Ben, whatever you'd like to call it. And on top of this is the three pyramids or the three pillars.
Yeah.
And then that's exactly what was the main things that were happening on 9/11 on Manhattan Island, with these three pillars on the mound, the Manhattan Island coming out of the water. So that symbolism seems to be even on the entire island.
Because I don't know if you know, isn't that... Do you know if the entire area is actually built afterwards, or were there some land there originally?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know about that.
Okay, yeah. Interesting nonetheless.
So,
You know, I'm
about photos where you can see the Statue of Liberty sort of, you know, looking in, very standing very near that island. It's all Egyptian. It's right there.
Yeah.
I think people get stuck at tracing it back to Templars and tracing it back to, you know, you have to go back to Egypt at least in your thinking.
Yeah.
To get what's happening here.
Yeah, I agree. You know.
Or ancient Egypt at least.
Ancient Egypt, yeah. Egypt. You know, I'm thinking about the concept of illumination. You're talking about this also a bit in your latest video, and one thing I find a little bit interesting, of course, is the fact that New York itself actually is referred to as you know, of course, the Big Apple.
Right.
And there might be a hint in there, I don't know, about the, you know, the forbidden fruit, or, you know, the fruit of knowledge or illumination, then, I guess, I don't know.
The Apple of Iris, which is another version of Isis, and the forbidden fruit, for sure, the Garden of Eden, being, in my mind, like a story connected to Akhenaten and connected to the Atlantean myth again.
Yeah, very interesting. You know that because the connection, you know, between, as you say, illumination or cosmic illumination and the 9/11 ritual, the question is kind of what that is. One interpretation I got was that 9/11, then, if I'm, you know, thinking about your latest video or your work here, and one of the things I was thinking about was that this event is a symbolic representation, you know, of the, either it's the destruction of illumination or it's the initiation of illumination, meaning that from that point in time, either illumination won't be possible, or that it's from this point that illumination will be possible. What's your idea about that?
Well, I think you're right in seeing it as both at once, because it does seem to be like it's either the beginning of like this really dark phase or the beginning of a really bright phase, depending on what we do and what we take out of the event of 9/11 and how we live our lives now and what we do with the information we've learned about 9/11 and perhaps from 9/11. I lean towards seeing it as an unveiling of light, as opposed from destruction, but that, I mean, they destroyed the pillars. And you can't get around that there's this weird either contradiction or a duality about the symbolism.
Indeed, you know, I'm thinking about, of course, the next step, as it were, in the process, because I know that you refer to this, when the Freedom Tower is going up there, that this has been kind of, the 11 years of kind of a Stargate opening, I guess?
Mm-hmm.
And,
the Freedom Tower obviously connecting, showing that the whole thing isn't complete, that there's still something happening at the World Trade Center Plaza.
Yeah.
With the occult symbolism at play in the Freedom Tower is just insane. Its number of feet in height is the founding date of the Illuminati.
Yeah.
It has this giant torch theme to it. It's got an octagon from the top. It's actually replete with symbolism. We're probably still decoded. It's standing on a cubic shape, a perfect cube, and then the tower sort of juts out of that. So it's all the symbolism sort of rolled into one and to be completed on 2012.
Yeah.
So is that sort of the ending of this ritual, or is that when the ritual is finally complete? I don't know. These are ideas which I keep trying to fit together.
And yeah.
Maybe if more people will also look into this area, we can work it out together.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. You know, I think the very dualistic in that way, because I feel it's like a taunt against the idea of freedom. I'm thinking about it like this, because they have performed the World Trade Center ritual on this spot, and they kind of, what should I call it, they load, so to speak, the area with very much negative association, even people's, you know, intention, energy from all the people, you know, across the world who think about the World Trade Center, think about this area, and now they're building what they refer to as the Freedom Tower on that exact same spot.
Yeah.
So the question is, is it a taunt against freedom, or what is it?
Well, that's a very complex question, and they raise so many issues. I see it as it's possible that the people who instigated 9/11, you know, they didn't create the situation. They sort of moved with time and tide. Like, there's a cosmic force that goes through everything. And 2012 is part of this sort of celestial, these big gears that are shifting over. And it's just because the conspiracy elites are so in tune with these that they move with them. And we'll see their footprint in these events because they're guiding and initiating these things. What we have to decide is whether we agree with what they're doing or whether we like to understand exactly what their goals are so that we can go, okay, well, our overseers or the smartest people are in charge of the ship, and I feel comfortable with that. Or maybe we're going to go, no, I think they're homicidal maniacs who are killing us en masse for their rituals. I don't know, but I think this area at least needs to be accepted by us that they are using us for rituals.
Yeah.
Do we want them to? Do we agree with their purposes? That's why these areas need so many, so much. That's why we need to look into them and investigate them. Because I don't feel like I have all these answers. I feel like I have a finger pointing. I don't have a final answer.
Yeah.
I have just as many questions about this 9/11 mega ritual.
And that's good, because that will keep you continue searching. And in a way, I think that that is the important thing, the journey itself, and maybe not the goal. I don't know.
I see it also as perhaps they have unconsciously become a figure for us to overcome. Like, they've twisted into a dark side, and now we have to rise to the occasion. And maybe the really top-level secret society initiates know this, that they've taken on the force, the dark force, so that mankind can rise to the challenge to overcome them, and then we've evolved, and then we've learned.
Oh.
But so that's also a possibility, but there's so many dynamics. Like, the moment we're reaching into these higher sort of spheres where you're thinking symbolically and metaphorically, and you know, if things take on many dualities, and the differences between good and evil become very flimsy and relative, and all this sort of thing. I just feel you got to guide yourself with trying to get rid of all the fear and ignorance inside you, and just work towards the love and enlightenment and humility, and you trying to really come to terms with the labyrinth of possibilities could drive you nuts. You just keep aiming towards, knowledge of yourself, and then part of this is to unravel these mysteries about what's happening in our environment, which is why I'm so into this 9/11 thing.
Absolutely, and in a way, as things are now, it does seem that humans or most humans, I guess I should say, actually needs a portrayal of darkness, or they need a period of turmoil to be able to locate themselves in the at least mentally in the sphere of, okay, I can recognize that this is darkness, this is bad, this is something that tells me something, and from that, at least now I know more, I know where I'm going. And as you say, this is a very, I think, delicate area, of course, because you're prancing on the borderline between, okay, are these guys insane, or is this something very, brilliant going on here that actually will awaken humanity? But I totally agree with you. It's very, not dangerous maybe, but very difficult and delicate to tread on this border, I think.
Right, and it's sort of like, if it's true, if we read Crowley and we read manifestos and literature that's out there of the OTO, the Rosicrucians and the Masons, the overarching idea is that they're working towards, at least under the levels of stuff that we can read. We're not members, we don't know the inner secrets.
Sure, yeah.
But we can intuit them, we can guess, and we can also, we can read what we have. And what I get from that is that, they're trying to work towards something good, something positive.
Yeah.
It's whether they've gone astray that is a question.
Yeah.
And and in the end, if they are doing their work correctly, then we're all working for the same individual, because as top leaders have to be this inner head or secret chiefs, the white light. That's this similar thing that's underneath all of us. So we all should be, in the end, working for the same goal. And maybe that's why they've just taken on this dark role, because we need an expression of that, because we can't deal with it internally. Now we have an external boogeyman, and obviously our illuminated seers, our shaman of our society, will take on the role that they're supposed to when it's necessary. So I don't that doesn't mean we should say, well, they're benevolent. I don't know, maybe, do they understand these things this way, not having access to what they know in these secret realms of their thinking and of their processes? We can only speculate. So
isn't that absolutely. I mean, that's I totally agree. It's fascinating what you say there, and I think you know, again, the question always goes back to the fact that, okay, do these guys actually know what they're doing, or have they got this, you know, idea, or rather, let's say like this, that if the universe favors a certain path, you know, that human beings or mankind should take at this point, then maybe the universe will find some way to express itself in that way, so we find, you know, we get on that path or on that route, and this might be one of the levels towards, you know, coming onto that path. I don't know.
Yes, I agree. It's so layered and fascinating.
It is absolutely. Yeah, you know, you mentioned also in your latest video a line. I just want to read it because I think it was, you know, very nice. It says, "The universe is alive, and that it is communicating to us in every point of space-time. Its language is far more rich and elegant than anyone composed of words." And I think that's very nice and very, you know, a very good way to view it. And I also want to tie this back to another point when you were talking about, I think, the cube of Hellraiser 2. During this passage, I think you said, have we discovered a message embedded in the space-time? And again, it keeps coming back to this idea or concept that there is a message or an underlying theme in space-time. Would you like to elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. What I was trying to explain there was just how, if you pay really close attention to your environment, you will realize it's a teacher. You know, you can follow the clues it keeps leaving you, and if you are paying attention, basically, if you just, you and your environment are starting to live in a sort of rhythm, then you start to realize that it's pulling you towards whatever goal you might have as an individual, and that to me is represented by synchromysticism. If I'm looking at the things I understand, movies, the things I was raised in. If I was another person, maybe I'd find patterns in the garden or in the rocks or the trees. But I was raised in this Western culture with movies and books and comics and all this media.
Yeah.
So I've started to look at the media space for patterns and connections, and I find a narrative in there that helps me to understand these everything I'm interested in, really, because there's so much media.
Yeah.
If you learn to look for the coincidences and the themes and the symbols that are always connected, and use your intuition as a guide, you get this amazing story coming out of it, and you can always, and you're involved in that story because you're trying to understand it, and just by being aware of your surroundings. And I don't think for everybody that would mean synchromysticism. For somebody it might mean Kabbalah or tarot or other tool, maybe just gardening again could be your tool. But it's just to learn this, basically, that you and your environment are in a relationship, that it, I mean, there are higher insights, like it's alive and you're actually not separate from it and this sort of stuff. But even if you can just get the sense that you and your environment are in a dynamic relationship with each other, then that's part of what I'm trying to say with those words.
Yeah, absolutely. Very beautifully put. And this is, again, something that is very important, I think, because in a way, many people might feel that, okay, certain aspects of our culture is, you know, is disconnected from you know, some kind of divinity, or that there is spirit in things that you know, take place in a I don't know what we should call it, a decadent, you know, cultural Western society or whatever. But it feels like, just as you say, if you look close enough and are paying attention, you can spot all of these, you know, mysteries and synchronicities beyond the surface of all, you know, all things, because everything in our universe can't be, or let me rather say that something in our universe can't, you know, cannot be a part of it. You know, it's right there, it's right in the middle. So whatever we will do, there will be an expression of something, a higher order, if you will, of the divine in everything we touch upon, I guess.
Agreed. I completely agree. It's just starting to realize that there's no separation between who's experiencing the thing and what's being experienced. It's sort of coming into the realization that that I suppose we're all one. I mean, it's sort of a phrase that gets misused, and but that's simply the highest the form that I can think of what I'm trying to say with synchromysticism.
Yeah.
Beyond all the secrets that we might gleam about these narratives of Atlantis and the 9/11 ritual, in the end, I'm trying to say that everything is connected. And if I can get out of a Donald Duck cartoon or a rapper or who knows, like, I don't know, a chocolate rapper or maybe even a hip-hop rapper, anything I can think of, if I use my intuition and I can find patterns in there, you can either think, well, this guy needs to be locked up, or if I can prove my point that every part of the universe is alive and connected, and that's insight in itself that's very important.
Yeah.
And it supersedes, to me, really, the 9/11 mega ritual and all these sort of secret society things that I'm trying to illuminate. The idea is that synchromysticism works.
Yeah.
And if it works, it means the universe is alive.
Yeah.
So if you can see that I'm finding some sort of pattern in everything, in any material that I'm familiar with, then that might help you to get to that insight.
Indeed, yeah, and I think it's good to kind of, you know, again go over some of these methods to kind of get, you know, people who aren't familiar with it in the right think, so to speak, of how this, you know, might come about, and how people, you know, themselves can see this in their own surrounding and pick up on it and feel like, okay, shit, I'm actually part of something, you know, huge right here, and that's, you know, that's empowering, that's positive in so many ways. So very good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's trying to understand that you are, you know, like such a big part of the equation. If it wasn't for you, in a sense, the entire universe wouldn't exist.
That's right.
Your entire world is only existing because of you.
Yeah.
And people are so, at the moment, so they have so little value for themselves, or they just see themselves as numbers, or there's so many billions of people on the planet that the very idea that, you know, you actually create the world around you in a very real sense. It's not the only thing. The world at the same time creates you. But you are in that equation, and that's really important.
Absolutely. I totally agree. You know, speaking about messages, how about, because I don't think we talked about this, because this was a news item that popped up a few months ago, I think. This is, of course, about the Saturn hexagon that popped up there, you know. I don't know if they have, you know, took pictures of this before, or if this was the only one. But anyway, as soon as I saw it, I you know, amazing. There's a amazing symbol right there. What's your take on that entire thing?
Well, I did a video on the Saturn hexagon, and I'm going to go into that area again because I think it's so important and just shows how, even on this macrocosmic level, I mean, this thing's giant. It's like 25,000 kilometers big.
Yeah.
There's this math, and where you see math, you've got to think intelligence.
Yeah.
But we're talking about a planet that's intelligent, because nature is intelligent. We are nature. Everything we make, movies, media, etc., is nature. We
that's
came
right.
out of the planet, the universe, etc.
Yeah.
So, and you know, you can see, realize that by looking at something like the Saturn hexagon.
Absolutely.
And just looking at it symbolically, you know, Saturn generally is connected to the ideas of death.
Yeah.
And the when as the story was developing about the Saturn hexagon, and by the way, they had discovered it before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they'd released photos, but years ago, they'd seen sort of a hexagon shape there, and they didn't think too much of it till they went by and it was still there, and yeah. got clear shots of it, and then they were like, well, this thing is it's a stable hexagon. It's going away. It's staying there.
Oh, man.
It's like in the cloud storm seen from the North Pole from the top.
Yeah.
There's this giant hexagon just rotating to the North Pole of Saturn. And what's really fascinating to me, and I'm trying to bring this up in one of my videos, maybe people can watch out for that, is the bees that were dying and how the hexagon shape is something that we would, the immediate shape that you would think of, the first shape of, when it comes to bees, is the honeycomb, which is a hexagon.
That's right, yeah. So
you could, in a way, I mean, it depends on your way of interpreting these things, you could think of the Saturn hexagon suddenly coming into the mediasphere and the bees dying coming into the mediasphere as being connected. And in my videos, I've gone into showing how Buckminster Fuller geodesic is connected to it because of the film Silent Running, that we see a hexagon through right on the Saturn planet, one of the shots from the movie.
Yeah.
And Buckminster Fuller's geodesics and the technologies that have been developed from this is being used in the Freedom Tower.
Interesting.
The spire is being made from technology that was developed from his geodesic domes.
Oh, really?
The spire right on top of the Freedom Tower.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and this one was it's going to have a light on it, right? That shines up.
That's right, like a giant beam of light is going to come out there, like shooting up, I don't know how many hundreds of feet into the air when it's completed, like every night or something like that.
Oh. Amazing. Yeah, that will be an incredible view, you know, when that's finished. I think it's going to be the tallest building in the world, at least at that time, I guess, when it goes up.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And another fascinating thing about the hexagon shape that was, somebody sent me a link, Richard Hoagland, I don't know if you're familiar with his work. He
indeed.
Popularized the face on Mars.
Yep.
And then you have... Iapetus, I think that's how you say it.
Iapetus,
the moon.
Yeah.
It has this very strange trench. Very much looks like the Death Star. It has this like crater impact and this trench. And he's theorized, Mr. Hoagland, that it's actually a geodesic. Like, he looks at the craters, and he believes that he has found evidence that it is a giant, like a man-made, or not man-made, obviously, like... not natural.
Yeah, it's an exactly
alien thing or other previous civilization or something that's not geological, at least, or whatever you would call it. It might have collapsed in on itself, causing that ridge. But what's fascinating to me is that independently, I did not know about this. I was using Saturn and the geodesic of Buckminster Fuller to describe one of my theories in my Saturn hexagon video. Now there's another connection to Saturn and the geodesic come to light, connected to Hoagland's work. And if we look at this, I'm giving a bit away about the videos I'm doing, on Star Wars, when they go attack the Death Star, the hole that Luke Skywalker shoots the missile in that actually blows up the Death Star is a hexagon.
Oh, man. Yeah, is it right?
To the hexagon, to Jupiter, to the Death Star, to Iapetus. You know, it all gets very complex and convoluted, and people might say, well, you can do that with anything, and that is kind of the point.
Yeah, exactly.
so it's very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. That's an incredible connection, and exactly. I know that Hoagland speaks about some of the what he refers to as the hyper-dimensional physics, and that this in some instances can take the form of for example, a pentagonal shape or a hexagonal shape and stuff like this. So again, it verifies the idea that there is an energy and a hyper-dimensional, as he calls it, physics involved in this, when a planet actually takes in energy and gives out energy, mainly, I guess, through the poles area, because that's where the magnetic field is emanating from and stuff like this. So there is indeed a very interesting connection there. And I also wanted to ask you, because you bring this up in your latest video, and this is of course about 2010 and the fact that they used Jupiter there, but not Saturn. I did not know about this. Tell us about that again.
Yeah, well, I haven't read the novel 2001, but doing research just on Wikipedia quickly revealed that originally in the novel version, it's not Jupiter that the Discovery goes to. Actually, in 2010, it's Saturn. So
yeah.
The planet, in a way, we could see as Saturn, and even they tried to make it Saturn in the film by Kubrick. They tried to make it Saturn, but the same visual effects producer of Silent Running, strangely enough, couldn't get the effects right. So they switched it to something less challenging without rings, Jupiter.
Hmm.
And then, you know, then we get the Silent Running connection later,
yeah.
The hexagon and the geodesic that we see.
Oh, man.
But,
yeah, that's a... Yeah, continue.
Well, then on the video I show another hexagon, because right on the booster rocket of the spaceship that's sent to investigate at Jupiter, it crosses the anomaly, the circular anomaly in the film 2010, and that seems to be very resonant, even the size.
Hmm.
Hal says, he says it's like 22,000 kilometers big.
Yeah.
It seems to me to be perfectly resonant of the hexagon on Saturn and the anomaly on Saturn being the anomaly in 2010 on Jupiter. So there's all these, there's this weird bleed through where sensitive people, perhaps artists like Arthur C. Clarke and
Rick,
pick up these meta themes that are going through our universe, and then by looking for these coincidences, we can intuit higher levels of reality, or maybe hidden realms, or maybe things that are possibly coming up in the future. If we think of the book of Goro Adachi, he's very into trying to see what's going to happen in the future with the Queen and the royals and stuff like that by following their patterns.
But
Saturn and NASA timing of their and their symbols and insignia, it's a fascinating area.
Absolutely.
Very, people are doing it, but totally, it's something that I hope people will start. It's just to make that leap of faith that it's acceptable to see patterns and everything, and you're not a kook and a nut.
Yeah.
that's
right, yeah. And again, we can tie the films and all of this back to the years themselves. 2001, obviously, again, a very important year. Then the film, second one, 2010, called The Year We Make Contact, and there's all of this interesting, recurrent themes of the times that we are in right now, in these few years that we have between, 2001 and up to 2012. Again, as you say, the 11-year opening, of the possibility of the Stargate is now open, basically.
yeah, and it's sort of like, this contact. I often say contact with higher intelligence is possible, or it might have been the intention of the ritual. And people immediately think of aliens, and that is one metaphor, and it might be perfectly valid, and it might be the expression that this idea takes, like alien contact or something like that.
Yeah.
But higher intelligence doesn't just mean aliens. It also means, contact with yourself, higher, the thing that's above us. Because even if there are aliens out there, the universe is populated by millions of beings, it's still in it. On a higher level, the entire universe is one. This insight I cannot run from.
That's right.
I've come to it a million times in my life, and So if one of the stages of our development is meeting a higher intelligence in the form of aliens, I hope they'll just tell us, of course you're right, we're all one consciousness. They'll probably know that, no problem. They exist independently.
Yeah.
So higher contact, it might be connected to the idea of us taking the leap of fear and saying, okay, there are aliens out there. And that might be a next stage for us to sort of accept. Because already there is so much evidence for the idea of spaceships or aliens, people who have these experiences, but it's like we can't pull it into the consensus reality where we all, you know, accept it, and maybe that's one of the parts of what's happening.
Hmm.
It's my 12.
Oh, very interesting. You know, just
buffet.
Absolutely. That's the whole idea. The one who's, you know, still around, hopefully will get to, you know, find out what it's all about. Maybe not everything, of course, but you know, at least the concept of the, you know, of the ideas of the timing right now, and of course leading up to 2012 and all of this. But you know, speaking about aliens, and I don't know if this is a connection that you want to make, but I know that you'll be you're going to pop over later in the summer, I guess, to the UK to, among other things, check out the crop circle seasons over there. It's you know, picking up always during the summer and intensifies at that point. And I know that you reference a few times here and there, you know, in your work, crop circles and all of this. What's have you come any closer, you know, for yourself of what these things might be? What are they? Who make them and so forth?
Well, the idea behind the crop circle fascination is still to me the mystery. I haven't come solving it. I haven't completely ruled out amazing group of, I don't know, 100 strong guys who are doing these landscape artworks, you know, in the middle of the night, like 4 hours in the rain. They're doing it and leaving no trace.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, I'd like to hunt them down and shake their hands and say congratulations. If not, you know, more likely it seems to be something mysterious and mystical, especially judging by all the shapes being new and interesting and innovative and not things you'd find in the tattoo parlor, you know, mathematical textbook. It's like they're new shapes that nobody's come up with. So it's art. Either way, it's art.
That's
high
right.
Art. And I'm very fascinated by them. But I personally intuit it's something mysterious. There's some kind of mandala connected to the Stargate, the higher consciousness theme, something we're still going to work out and solve.
Interesting, yeah.
Maybe some sort of feedback between a planet that's starting to become aware, if you think of the planet like an egg that's about to hatch into space.
Yeah.
You know, we're about to become a spacefaring nation.
So
there's these glyphs connected to, you know, maybe something. Well, there's so many ideas about that. And there is a weird feedback loop between, you know, popular culture events and the symbols, because we'll see these taking on expressions about events that are happening, you know, hexagons and, well, last year we had one that looked sort of like you could imagine them being like three prongs or three pillars or three towers maybe coming out of the crop or out from a star.
It was kind of a third-dimensional image, I guess. Was that the one?
A three-dimensional image, yes. Like from above, this sort of implosion or explosion of three square-like structures. That
seemed
to me very resonant,
at
least of 9/11. But I see 9/11 in everything. I see Stargates everywhere, so it might not be the most independent authority to ask about the subject. But to me, there's a relationship between the crop circles and us.
Yeah.
Definitely. Even if they're coming from somewhere else, it's interacting with our minds and our wishes and our will. But it's not as simple. I don't have a simple answer, but I'm open about it.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's just people necessarily making them. If they are, they're a highly skilled, organized a group with mathematical knowledge. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard of the UMMO. There was the
UMO. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
UMO, is that how you say it?
I think so. I'm not sure, but yeah.
Yeah, like all these scientists were getting these letters, and they even influenced. They claimed the letters were claimed to be from alien intelligences, and or just a group called UMO, and the knowledge contained, according to Robert Anton Wilson, at least in these letters, influenced philosophers, and was like important ideas that hadn't been thought of up until then.
Huh.
You know? So it could have been a group of people, but it would have to be an incredible group of people or an individual. And either way, I'm interested. These are fascinating ideas.
Ah, fascinating.
There's no way to lose with the crop circle thing and phenomena.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in a way, we're always so you know, we're very focused on, okay, what is it, who does it, how did they do it, and it's like, okay, when we know that mystery solved, it's all over. But that's, I think, missing the point. Just as you say, it's about, okay, they are there, their art, you know, they're beautiful, they're magnificent, and you know, enjoy them, and you know, learn from them, look at them. That's the point, not, you know, who made them or for what reason, basically.
Yeah, I remember the biggest, one of the most impressive, one that happened on Mulkeol in 2001, and mm-hmm. it was this giant geometric sort of spiraling multi-armed Mandelbrot type design.
Mm-hmm.
It was about 400 circles big. Like they, it would have taken, like, if you made one circle, every 30 seconds, you would just get finished with the amount of nighttime provided at that, that time of the year.
Oh, man.
It was raining as well.
Huh. You know?
And this happened like a month after 2001. It's the biggest, most impressive, at least to me, crop circle ever. And, you know, I call 9/11 a Stargate event, and often I call crop circles a Stargate. So it's weird to have like the biggest, most impressive, most difficult to refute as not coming from some sort of mysterious force, crop circle happening.
Yeah.
Within a month of this 2001.
Very.
Is amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
the Mulkeol Mega, it could be called that, I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'll Google it.
Ah, very interesting. Yeah, definitely I need to take a look at that. You know, around in the area where you're at now, do you ever get any crop circles up there?
Canada gets a few crop circles a year. They get maybe three or four in a good year.
Okay.
Or on a normal year.
Yeah.
And, since I've been living in Canada, there haven't been any in the area for me to go have a look at. So.
Any speculations on why so many of them seem to be appearing mainly on in Great Britain?
Well, there's a lot of literature, and there's a great documentary out there. There's a crop circle documentary.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what it was called. I don't know. People have to just go on Google and type in crop circle documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Go to movie database or something.
Was it the Mysteries of the Field or something like that?
That's right. I think it was the same guy who made the Waco documentary.
Oh, okay.
Good one as well.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And in this, they speculate a lot about the water table and the chalk in the ground and how it creates a magnetic field. Maybe the conditions are just right. But then, we also have the hinges and the mounds in that area.
That's right.
And it seems that there's a connection between that as well. And, I mean, I've been reading Ralph Ellis's Fauve, Architect of the Universe, and he speculates that Stonehenge is made by the same builders of the pyramids. It's not an entirely unlikely scenario in my head, or at least the same architects, designers, were behind it and might have employed the regional people to build these things, like 10,000 plus years ago. There's no crops, no giant amount of crops around the pyramids, so maybe there's no crop circles around the pyramids.
That's right. Maybe I think there are reports of what they refer to as sand circles, but
I have heard of those too. There was this giant mandala in the sand. I don't know where it was, but that thing is amazing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Again, very interesting. I know that you're, as I said, heading over to the UK, take a look at that. Are you going to film anything over there or something like that?
I will try and take as many photos as I can. I don't even have, I have a normal digital camera.
Yeah.
I could take like 5 minutes of footage on. I don't even have anything like that.
Yeah.
If I did, I would, but, I'll do everything I can to document the experience, and I'll probably put updates on my blog about what's happening there, if anything interesting.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Hopefully there will be, as you say, a good influence on the time when you're actually there, so things, interesting circles pop up and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's up in the air because, the circles are different every year. They come at different times and in different intensities.
Yeah.
So it's just luck. We'll see what happens.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, we have to save a few points here. I did want to talk a little bit about the Simpsons and even the Super Mario show, but hey, sure. You know, I would love to do, you know, another interview down the road at some point. And I know that you're working on you know, new material and getting stuff out there. But before we finish off here today, Jake, I would you know, want you to give out all the details so people know how they can view your videos, how they can, you know, of course, read your posts, and also how people can get a piece of your, you know, your beautiful artwork, because almost to every post that you do an original artwork to that. I guess it's mostly pencil, and it's very beautiful. Tell people how they can get that.
Okay. Well, if you go to the Brave New World Order, .blogspot.com, you can find links to my different websites. I have a few, but the primary one, with the Brave New World Order at .blogspot.com, will connect you to all the relevant sites. I have artwork up on a blog that you'll find the link for there that I sell.
Yeah.
If people are interested in purchasing any of that, it helps me the whole thing going.
Yeah.
And I have t-shirts that I've put some of the designs on, and I've got all my interviews are up there, and even the videos, which you can either just go to YouTube and type in my name or the Brave New World Order, or you could just go again to my website and just there's a link on the side that says synchromistic videos, and people can get all the videos collected together on that one YouTube channel site thing.
Excellent, yeah, and
if you just go there, and then you're good.
Absolutely, yeah. The Brave New World Order .blogspot.com. That's the main site to check out for much more of Jake's work. And I got myself one of those T-shirts, and I, you know, they're very beautiful. I got the one with the alien face on it. It's a beautiful style, and love it very much. So definitely, people, check that out if you want to, you know, support Jake's work and make sure that he can continue what he's doing. So again, check out his website, thebravenewworldorder.blogspot.com. And again, Jake, I want to thank you so much for coming on, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm looking forward to very much speaking with you again.
Well, thank you very much, Heinrich. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the program. Remember that you can participate in the show. You can comment or drop a question to one of our guests. Just click on radio in the menu on the left-hand side on our site redicecreations.com. In the radio section, you'll find upcoming guests and all the details on how to leave your message or question. Our next show on Sunday, Alan Watt is going to be back with us, and next Thursday we have Andy Lloyd scheduled to talk about the dark star / Planet X. So good stuff coming up as we get back into the flow of things after our somewhat week and a half break here. Many thanks to Fredrik behind the controls. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and we will talk more on Sunday again. Take care.